And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho. Welcome to the show, where we interview legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today, 941-877-1552, or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Hey, you remember Sweets for My Sweet, Needles and Pins, When You Walk in the Room, Sugar and Spice, Don't Throw Your Love Away, Love Potion Number 9, to name just a few? The Searchers, tied for the second group from Liverpool after the Beatles to have a hit in the U.S. when their Needles and Pins and the Swinging Blue Jeans' Hippie Hippie Shake both reached the Hot 100 on March 7th, 1964. It's little wonder, then, that most observers consider the Searchers to be the most successful and important group after the Beatles in that quite wonderful period of pop music. Man, I really miss those days. Originally founded as a skiffle group in Liverpool in 1959 by John McNally and Mike Pender, the band took their name from the classic 1956 John Wayne Western, The Searchers. The band grew out of an earlier skiffle group formed by McNally with his friends Brian Dolan and Tony West. When the other two members lost interest, McNally was joined by his guitarist neighbor, Mike Pendergrast. They soon recruited Tony Jackson with his homemade bass guitar and amplifier and styled themselves Tony and the Searchers with Joe Kelly on drums. Kelly soon left to be replaced by Norman McGarry, and this lineup, McNally, Pender, as he soon became known, Jackson, and McGarry, that is usually cited as the original foursome. The band returned to a residence at the Iron Door Club, and it was there that tape recorded the sessions that led to a recording contract with the infamous Pye Records with Tony Hatch as producer. Hatch played piano on some recordings and wrote Sugar and Spice, the band's second number one record under the pseudonym Fred Nightingale, a secret he kept from the band at the time. The group continued to tour through the 70s and were rewarded in 1979 when Sire Records signed the band to a multi-record deal. The two albums were released by them, The Searchers and Play for Today, retitled Love's Melodies, outside the UK. Both records garnered great critical acclaim but did not break into the charts. They did, however, revitalize the group's career. According to John McNally, the band were ready to head into the studio to record a third album for Sire when they were informed that due to label reorganization, their contract had been dropped. In 1981, the band signed to PRT Records, which was formerly Pye, their original label, and began recording an album, but only one single, I Don't Want to Be the One, backed with Hollywood, saw the light of day at that time. The rest of the tracks would be released as part of 2004's 40th anniversary collection. 1985, Mike Pender left the Searchers to form his own group. His aim was, and still is to this day, to faithfully recreate the sound and feel of those hit recordings, and at that time, introduce other material that complements Mike's unique voice and guitar style. In 1988, Coconut Records signed the Searchers, and the album Hungry Hearts was the result. A very contemporary-sounding release, it featured modern-sounding remakes of Needles and Pins and Sweets for My Sweets. While the album was not a major hit, it did keep the group in the public eye. John McNally and the Searchers are still going strong today and hold a significant fan base worldwide. The band members are John McNally, original member and founder, 6-string and 12-string guitars and vocals, Frank Allen on bass guitar, vocals, and frontman, Spencer James, guitar, synthesizers, and lead vocals, and Scott Ottaway on drums. Please welcome guitarist and vocalist, was one of the original founders of the Searchers from 1957 and still with the band over 50 years later, John McNally. Hello, John.
Good day. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Congratulations on performing with the Searchers for over 50 years, man. That's a long time.
Well, it's been fun all the way, and unfortunately, you know, you do have the little bad moments, the bad periods. But most of all, it's been great. I'm very lucky to have such a career, and that was a great, concise intro as well.
Oh, thank you very much. I could go on and on. You know, there is a lot more, but you know, I didn't
yeah.
want to bore everybody.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of stuff
interview.
To go on. Yeah, I mean,
it
50 odd years, there's so much in 50 odd years, and you can't do it all.
Exactly. Well, the group still sounds fantastic. I mean, I checked you guys out on some recent shows you did, and the band is so tight. You know, I think that's just, you know, hard work, man, because you guys tour extensively.
Yes, it's the good thing about it. Overall, we enjoy it, and we like playing, and it shows. And we like to make sure that the music is spot on. Although there's some nights you feel iffy or bad, you know. But overall, 90%, we always try our best.
So you're kind of like the George Harrison of the Searchers, right? You're the quiet searcher. Kind of like George with
well,
the Quiet Beatles, is there?
Well, sort of. I just find it's. I enjoy the music. I don't enjoy the sort of add-ons that you might say. I just like just playing live and enjoying music.
Well, you guys are extremely busy. I haven't seen so many tour dates in a long time from any band. I'm serious. Even the big boys today are not touring as much as you guys. And you're going to be extremely busy through March 2019.
Yeah,
at
the moment, we're having a break. We've got 4 or 5 weeks off break, and then we start again. And basically, we've had our... Economically, we have to work that out because we have a big crew. We have large wages to pay. And two crew members who have been with us for 30 years. So
wow.
We run it as a business, so it's got to have a steady course of income, so people are paid.
You got the '60s Gold Autumn Tour coming
yep.
up. You got a lot of little variations of different tours coming up. That's got you guys, PJ Proby, the Mercy Beats, the Fortunes, and Steve Ellis and Vanity Fair will also be on that bill. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's a good bill. PJ is a favorite of ours. Frank and I like PJ Proby very much. His voice is great, and we feel he's badly done by, and he deserves more tours. And we always get him on our tours when we can.
Do you know Jerry Marsden?
Oh, Jerry's not too good at the moment.
Really?
He's retired. He's retired, so he's a bit. He's not well.
I heard he wasn't doing so well. That's why I asked. I wanted to see how he was doing. I met Jerry a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah, he was in the local paper about a week ago, and he looked bad. He's in very bad health, and he was going to do a farewell show in Liverpool, but I don't think he's going to do it because he's not well enough.
Oh, that's pretty sad. He's such a nice guy too.
Yeah, he's great. I've known him for 55 years.
Wow. And sadly, I hate the report, and I'm sure a lot of your fans already know this. There's going to be a Searchers farewell tour, which is going to end March 31st, I guess.
Yes, Frank is quite. I mean, he's feeling the pressure, but he's not feeling the pressure. It's the motorways over here. Very poor, and I mean, it's just gridlocked, and trying to get to a venue and get back from the venue is absolutely a nightmare. So Frank said, I can't do it anymore. So we decided to retire.
Wow. What? So, and I understand that last date is already sold out, and that's already.
Well,
they're
all sold out, basically.
Yeah.
It's the way it is. We were. We thought long about it, and you have your doubts about it, you feel you're going to miss it, and we certainly are going to miss it. I will anyway. But Frank, seriously, he can't stand the pressure of the motorways anymore.
Frank Allen, I want to remind our viewers, was the bass player with the Searchers since 1964 in the band. He also played with Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers as well.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yes, Frank's, from the beginning, Frank became a very, very good front man for the band because his chat and his introductions are very funny, and it's all ad-lib, and he links all the songs together very good.
So, John, what are you going to do after retirement?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I really don't know. Billy Kinsley from the Mersey Beats, he says, you know, we'll start a little band up in Liverpool. So it's funny, I don't know what to do.
But it sounds like you got still a lot more life in you to, you know, maybe do some more gigs.
Well, the office, Alan Freels, has tried to talk me into keeping it going. I'm in two minds. I haven't decided yet. But like 50-odd years is to basically start again with a new bass player. But people say, why not? And I'm thinking, well, why not? So I haven't decided as yet.
Yeah, it's a tough decision, you know.
It's just difficult. And also you get the pressure from the missus. Who suffered 54 years of me on the road. She wants me to pack it in as well.
Well, she's the boss, so you got to listen to her.
Well, she's not the boss, but, you know, you do feel for her when she's been like, she's got to put up with a musician for 54 years.
Yeah. God bless
her.
That's
not easy.
It isn't easy at all. Did you play with Fats Domino at one time?
Oh, yeah, at Star Club. That's the good thing about when we did our early days, when we followed the Beatles into the Star Club, we took over from the Beatles. We came the night they were finishing their stint, a month stint, and we played with the likes of Gene Vincent, our idols, Fats Domino, Little Richard, Joey D and the Starlighters, Ray Charles, and the Everlys. It was fantastic, the Star Club. And all those American acts we watched and sort of copied in a way, and we loved what they did. The only one I missed, and I regret it. He played Liverpool, 20th March 1958, was Buddy Holly.
Wow. Yeah.
He's the only one I missed. I was working late that night, and I missed him.
Oh man, that's a shame. I knew some people that knew Buddy Holly. Trini Lopez.
Friends with Buddy Holly. Well, we played with Trini Lopez as well.
How about it? Yeah, he's a good guy. He's still rocking and rolling. He's still out there.
Is he? Well,
real nice guy.
We played with him in Berlin.
Huh. Yeah, he was asked to join the Crickets, as a matter of fact.
Was he?
After Buddy Holly passed away.
Fantastic.
Yep.
But, you know, Buddy, Buddy's my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah, he influenced a lot of people, didn't he? That was real rock and roll was back then. Yeah.
Well, he influenced us and Beatles as well, and Hollies. I mean, he influenced so many people. It was just in Britain. I mean, he was the king.
Yeah, that's true. I interviewed a lot of guys from Liverpool. Billy J. Kramer, another nice guy.
Oh, Billy,
Pete Best. Yep. Talked to Pete a bunch of times. Another good guy.
Yeah.
How
is Billy J?
Oh, he's doing good. He's doing fine. You know, it's funny. I met him when I met Jerry Marsden back in Washington. They did a British oldie show, and I went backstage, and I met him and Kramer, and the Trogs were there, and Badfinger. It was a great show. And he was so thin back then. And now he's, you know, now he's huge. I got pictures with me and him, and he's so skinny, you know, back in that time.
Yeah.
I reminded him.
A nice lad, Billy.
Very nice guy. Very nice guy. Oh, all you guys from Liverpool are nice. You're great people.
Well, you know, I think it's the northern friendliness, which, I mean, anywhere around the northwest is fine.
Right. I talked to a few guys from Liverpool back in the day, and you know, there wasn't really much competition. That you were all happy that there were other bands from Liverpool making it, but I did hear some angst when it came to the Dave Clark Five.
Dave Clark Five, the only thing wrong with that, they just had suspicions that he never played the drums.
Right, and, exactly. That's what I heard.
Yeah, and a lot of bands like ourselves were totally live. We recorded all together. And he was using a drummer and just pretending to play the drums. So those little things, I know it's naive and petty, but, I mean, those two things did wrangle with sort of a lot of the Liverpool bands.
Yeah, and let's see, there are bands also from Birmingham, well, I guess that were a little bit more competitive, right?
Well, I bet they all slightly came. I don't think there was no animosity between all the bands, because, I mean, the Birmingham bands were very good. They had their own unique sound. Manchester also had unique sounds. Newcastle and London, it all just came about just after the Liverpool scene.
I think the Moody Blues were from Birmingham, and they started
early.
Moody
Blues still going.
I talked to Mike Pinder and also Ray Thomas before, you know, he was kind of a friend. I know him and his wife, and, you know, it was very sad when he passed away, but they had some, you know, great stories from back in the early days, too, because they started out as kind of an R&B band.
Yeah, we've all got great stories, you know, but especially when we all get together.
Exactly.
Some that can be told and some that can't be told. So we can we do reminisce when we get together. Well, many, I mean, the people that are alive, like I'm saying.
Well, you had a genius working for you guys in the name of Tony Hatch, which Tony's still around. He's still going.
Tony, yeah, but he doesn't look well. We saw him the other week in London. Yeah, he lives in Mallorca. He looks his age now.
Yeah, I've been trying to get him on the show as well, and because
Alan Field should help you.
Oh, good. I did go to his website, and I think I did get the information, and I'm just waiting. I put in the request early, so I'd love to have him on the show. I interviewed Petula Clark. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I think if you mention the searches to Tony, I'm sure he would. If you get hold of him, Alan Field will get in touch with him, get a number for him. I'm sure it's Mallorca or Menorca he lives.
Right. Yeah, he worked for Pi as well.
Yeah.
And he was the only, let's see, on the UK charts, he was one of the first guys, I think, to produce your music, I think, in true stereo, right?
Yeah, we put that down to the engineer, Ray Prickard.
Right.
It was very unusual. Everyone was in mono, and we didn't realize this until later on years when they started reissuing them, because the Beatles, if you play the Beatles' early tracks, they're all strange, like the voices on one side and drums are on the other side. There's no proper mix of the stereo. But when you play ours, they're all in stereo. So Ray Prickard must have been well ahead of everybody, and so was Tony. And we were very lucky, but because Ray was a more classical producer, engineer, I must say.
It's amazing. You know, I still love those early 45 records. and the albums, of course, because to me it's got a very unique sound. You know, you got the Echoplex in the background on the 45s, and you can't reproduce that sound anymore, you know?
No, I mean, in fact, I've I intend buying a new deck, just play all my vinyl, and because I like vinyl better than the CDs, I'm afraid.
So do I.
I just find CDs are flat, and I like the old, sort of the odd note coming out of the vinyl, the odd bass note and things. And some of the reissues of the CDs, sometimes you don't hear the guitar solos and stuff like that, which is very odd. It's all down to frequencies, of course.
I agree.
Yeah.
And the Searchers sound, you know, on album and 45 was so distinct and so clear, you know, and very, very much like the Beatles, you know. It had that kind of sound.
Well, I've always said we owe everything to the Beatles. The Beatles opened the door. They were the key. They got us through and made London look at Liverpool, and we got our chance. And we'll always say thanks very much to the Beatles.
How close were you to the Beatles as the band grew? I mean, did you guys see each
basically,
other
we... We did all the venues that they did, and of course we passed each other on the stairs and things, taking our gear in and out.
We did
the same. The Star Club Hamburg, we knew them, but once we all had the hits, particularly the Beatles, they became basically separate. Although they used to invite us to all their parties in London, they suddenly became separate from everybody else because they were so big.
Yeah,
it was the Untouchables, if you might say. We knew the Stones more because we toured with the Stones in '66.
Really?
So Southern Hemisphere tour with them, and they were great.
I had I was lucky to have Peter Asher on the show.
Peter, we played with him the other year in Canada.
Huh. Yeah, he's a very nice guy. He was talking about, you know, we were talking about how he was at his sister's house,
Jane Asher,
when they wrote Hard Day's Night. And McCartney, I guess, came up and asked his opinion on the song. And, that's some great stories there, Peter.
The Beatles, and because everyone toured together, and it was like, it was just fun. I mean, those days, you had a tour bus in England, but nowadays you just travel there on your own, and you meet up at the gig, and you do your gig. But those days, you all got on the bus and toured in the bus. So there was fun and games all around, really.
I don't know how you guys did it. I mean, that's a lot of traveling, you know?
Well, we were young. That's
the
point. We were young, and we didn't mind it. And also, the roads were clear. I mean, it takes longer to get to a gig now than it did in the 60s.
Do you have any good stories about female fans?
No. Not when you're talking to a married man.
I talked to Engelbert Humperdinck about that, and he had some great stories.
Oh, I'm sure he did. I mean, we played with him as well, Engelbert. Yeah, it's funny.
Everyone I talk to, and they talk about the 60s and the 50s and all that. I mean, Lonnie Donegan's name always comes up. You know,
he was great. In fact, I'm sitting here, and there's a picture of me with Lonnie in front of me.
You with Lonnie, huh? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We were doing it, wasn't it? We were playing in London, and you know, we've always liked him, and he comes to say hello before he died. And I've got his picture. I've got a picture of him with me with Lonnie, and above him is a picture of me with Abba.
He passed away before he was going to perform at a memorial concert for George Harrison with the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, he was. He was, but he kicked the bucket before he could do it, you know. So I think it was in Spain, wasn't he?
Yeah. He died young, 71. That's not that's
Yeah,
very
I mean,
old,
it's not that
know?
Age young, and it's, especially in this game. So, but, I mean, he had a good run. He had a good one. He was that nice bloke. And a great back. Unbelievable.
Hmm. Well, why do you think he was so instrumental to, you know, music?
I think it was just prior to the American explosion of like Eddie Cochran and Buddy and all those people playing a guitar. All those young lads after the war in Liverpool were into people like Lonnie Donegan, because Lonnie was coming on playing guitar, and he had a guitarist called Denny Wright and Les Oboe, and he always had great guitarists, and we used to watch him, and also all the skiffle bands like the Woodied Man and the Vipers skiffle group. All those people were influencing us, and then once the American explosion came, The Girl Can't Help It came. Well, that was it. All the Liverpool lads jumped on that.
Yeah, so he was very so important to those bands.
He was.
Like the blues were, you know, the early blues guys were to rock and roll as well.
He came from a jazz band anyway.
He did.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. Terry Lightfoot, was it? Or Terry I'm trying to think of the band, because the Cavern used to be jazz.
Right.
Terry Lightfoot, Chris Barber, he was in. And it was when, before the beat groups, all the jazz at the Cabinet was Tuesday nights. And then all of a sudden, the Blue Jeans were on Tuesday night. Well, they were a skiffle type group as well. They had a banjo.
Right.
And then they booked a big group. I don't know what big. It must have been like someone like Rory Storm.
Right,
the
Tuesday
Rory night.
Storm, yeah. Ringo. Yeah.
And it was called the Swinger Blue Jeans Guest Night. And then started Ray McFall, the owner, started booking the Beatles, Rory Storm, Jerry, ourselves, and all those people. And suddenly the Cavern exploded. And that's the beginning.
Such a small place, too, you know.
It's a strange place. You smell after it. 2 days, you're still smelling of it.
I just can't imagine that, you know, just drinking beer with the smoke in the air.
Don't drink beer. It's with soft drinks.
Soft drinks now. You can't drink anymore there. Huh.
No, it was soft drinks then. Everybody used to go to the grapes.
Soft drinks. They didn't have beer there. Okay.
Yeah, they had the Coca-Cola and stuff like that. And everyone used to drink in the grapes opposite and then go to the Cavern.
Now they got like a reproduction of the Cavern, right? That looks like the
Cavern, but it's not
the original Cavern.
It's a bit sad. You know, it moved it really and redesigned it. But even the backdrop is not the same.
Not the same, huh? Yeah.
No, all the names are all wrong on it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
we always used to know where our name was, and it's not there anymore. It's strange.
No. Well, Pye Records was infamous.
It's typical of the Liverpool Council. They don't know what they've got, and they're ruining it.
Yeah. There's a lot of... I was checking out Liverpool, because at one time I was going to visit Liverpool because I owned a dry cleaning plant. You know, I've done a lot of things in my life. Yeah, dry cleaning. And the company was actually from Liverpool. It was called the Johnson Group. And they were going to give me
Johnson's factory.
Yeah, you know them, Johnson?
Yeah, by Lineker Lane on, what's the road? Was it Knowsley Road? Knowsley Road goes to Stanley Road. But I used to work just there. Johnson factory. Yeah, I used to work in the Lane, the Black
Tie. They were
going to
give me a tour. They were going to give me a tour of Liverpool, and I ended up selling the business.
It doesn't exist anymore.
It doesn't exist anymore, huh?
Yeah, funny enough, I picked the grandkids up from school, and some lad gave me a book yesterday about Bootle, and it shows you the Johnson factory.
Really?
It's quite unusual, actually, you bring that up.
Huh. Yeah, they owned a string of dry cleaners here in America.
Yeah, it was huge. It was huge, Johnson's.
Yeah.
And their major factory was in, I forget what, I could go down and get the book and tell you. But it was amazing.
How about that?
Yeah, it's good.
Well, they were very good at the time. They were very, very good.
Yeah, they were the biggest cleaners going.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Amazing.
How about
that? I think we used to get our stage suits clean there.
How about that?
Yeah.
That's funny. It's a small world, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Amazing, really. Yeah. Johnson's, God.
The Johnson Group.
The Dye Factory and everything.
How about that? Yeah, I gave that up. I sold the business back in the 90s, mid-90s, late 90s or something like that. It was a lot of work because I had a full-service plant with 25 employees, and it was just, you know, smelling the chemicals all day. And
It
was a lot of work.
I mean, you can smell Johnson's miles away.
Yeah. Yep, the percolethylene, that's the dry
cleaner. But it was good for the people who worked there. Lots of people worked there, and it was good employment.
You know, the percolethylene, which is the dry cleaning fluid, you smell that all day. We were high all day from that stuff.
Well, you would do, wouldn't you?
it was like drinking a bunch of beers. It really was.
Well, I know. I understand. I used to know people who worked there. It was amazing.
We were all high. I mean, I was high for almost 5 years there.
My God.
Oh, and it was legal.
Joke, it? Yes, you don't need to go on the booze.
No, just sniff dry cleaning fluid.
Yes, that's it. Well, it smells strong.
Very strong. And I cleaned the filters out from the machines, which was supposed to wear a mask, you know, but
yeah.
I never wore it.
Well, I mean, those days of health and safety, there was non-existent,
right.
Wasn't it?
Right. Yeah, I didn't wear anything, you know. And then we had a boiler,
black tie wire, which was around the corner from Johnson's, and we used to work in all kinds of conditions, and we used to ignore it, you know. And basically, it wasn't until I went to Start Club and then I had to pack in my job that I got out of it. So it was strange, really.
So a lot of people lost their jobs from there, from Johnson, huh?
Yeah, when the 60s was always full employment in the 60s, but as that our 60s give up, then the 70s kept coming. Suddenly it became people were getting sacked and unemployment was quite big at that time. So you know, it's just progression.
Right, sign of the times. Pi Records was huge. You guys were on the Pi Record label. And, you know, Petula Clark was on there. You guys, the Kinks.
Yeah.
Lots of bands were on there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's owned by BMG now.
Is it? Huh.
Yeah, and BMG are releasing a double CD in about a few months, which is going to include our Sire stuff, our Pi stuff, some new stuff, and what's the ones? We did did an album I can't remember. They're releasing the mixture of all of them. So it's a double CD. It's going to be released soon, about a month or two.
Oh, good.
So to coincide with our sort of farewell tour type thing. So I'm looking forward to that. It's nice to wear all those songs together, particularly the Sire stuff. We do a couple of those on stage. We do Hearts in Our Eyes and Another Night and It's Too Late. So we do a few of the Sire stuff.
You guys did a cover version of What I'd Say by Ray Charles in the early days. That was unbelievable.
Yeah, we did.
Oh, my God.
That was
incredible.
That was in the Star Club, Hamburg.
It's on YouTube. There's a version of that on YouTube, which I saw, which was what a fantastic cover of that. It's probably the best cover I've ever seen.
But, I mean, it's just us going mad. We had a few drinks and stuff, and we did lots of that stuff at Star Club Hamburg. And we did another one called Sweet Nothings by Brenda Lee.
Oh, by Brenda Lee, yeah.
Yeah, we did that as well, and we did it one night, and she was in the audience.
Oh, really?
And she came back and, yeah, she came back and said it was great. But it's a crazy version.
Mm. You guys must have had a thing for Jackie DeShannon.
Oh, Jackie, not me really. It was at that period. What did we do? We got needles from Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers because
right.
We were watching them one night at the
right.
Star Club, and they played Needles and Pins. But Cliff Bennett had a brass section, and we thought that was odd, and so we asked Cliff, where'd you get that song? And they said it, and he told us it was Jackie DeShannon. So when we got home, Chris, our drummer, got a copy, and we did our version for quite a while. And then when it was a hit, we got these other demos came over, and one was Walking the Room. And we did
both
that
of
one
those
as well.
Jackie DeShannon hit, yep. But,
yeah,
but your versions
so
are so much better than, yeah.
And there's also a few tracks on the album written by Jackie. So, yeah, but I never met her, but it was always Chris and Frank in London who would meet her because mm-hmm. I stayed in Liverpool.
Let's see, Jackie's hit came in 63, and I think yours was 64. But,
yeah.
You know, there's a big difference in both of the songs. I mean, you know, I wasn't real happy with Jackie's version, really, to be honest with you. I like Jackie, but...
I always liked the originals. I'm just like that. I just like the original Jackie's. I like the original Needles and Pins.
Right.
I can't remember what Walking the Room is like, but I do like Jackie's voice.
Yeah, I like her voice too. She's done lots of great hits.
Oh, amazing! I mean, Betty Davis's Eyes was great.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Needles and Pins was a song written by Jack Nitschke and Sonny Bono.
Sonny Bono,
Sonny Bono. I never knew that. I never knew Sonny Bono was part of that writing team as far as the song.
No. I mean, that must have earned them a fortune over the years.
Oh, my God.
An absolute fortune. It's on everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always on the radio and stuff like that. It's crazy. But so unusual. And the funny thing is, we had to fight Pi Records for them to release it. They didn't want to release it. They just wanted to release another Drifters song, and we said, no, it's, you know, got to be Needles and Pins. And we fought for a couple of weeks, and in the end they gave in, and when Needles was released.
The other song cover that you guys just blew away was Love Potion Number 9.
We found that Chris and I were walking through Hamburg, and we came to a small record shop, and we went in and we looked around the 45s, and we found this record by the Clovers, and we played it, and Love Potion Number 9, oh, hang on, here's a good, nice song, and we just went in the Star Club and just learnt it, and that was another one of ours. I just picked it up by chance in Star Club Hamburg.
Yeah, that's one of those songs you remember from the 60s that stay in your head forever, you know?
Oh, yeah, it wasn't a hit over here.
Really?
What, no, it wasn't released.
Huh.
Funny,
I know
it?
That. It is funny.
Yeah, it was never released. It was released on an extended player, which got into the single charts. But it was never released as a single.
But it hit, it was number 3, though, on Billboard, right, in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think the reason being it wasn't released because Tony Jackson, when he left, he recorded it and released it as a solo song.
Great song. Fantastic
song.
Yes,
and that's why, but it wasn't a hit.
Huh.
So I don't know why they never released ours. We don't know why.
Yeah, that's interesting. Sugar
yeah,
and Spice was written by Tony Hatch, right?
Yeah, actually it was one of those being naive musicians, well, lads from Liverpool, really. We didn't know you make a lot of money by writing songs, you know, and writing B-sides and stuff in that period. And Tony came in the studio when we were looking for a follow-up to Sweets. And he said, I was in this club last night, blah, blah, blah. And a nice song this fellow was playing, blah, blah, blah. Sounds like this, and he plays on the piano. Unknown to us, it was Tony, under the pseudonym of Fred Nightingale. So
right.
He copped all
Fred
the money.
Where did he come up
but
with
we
that?
We didn't know. Yeah, we didn't know. We were so naive and hadn't learned a thing.
Yeah, that's funny. Don't Throw Your Love Away made number one, I think, in the UK, didn't it, in 64?
It did. It was on the radio today. I was listening to Radio
really?
2, and they played it today, yeah.
That's pretty cool, huh? When you still hear your music after all these years on the radio.
Yeah, like you said, it sounds very clear.
It does. It blows anything away today, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I'm amazed how clear and precise and in time it is, considering we never worked with a click track. So.
You guys were also appeared in a movie. It was called Saturday Night Out, right?
Saturday Night Out. We appeared in that, and that's another one. Saturday Night Out was another pseudonym with Tony Hatch. And we're also in another movie. We all did the backing music also for The System. Have you heard of The System?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We did the backing music for that. And that was written by Don Black, I think. We just did the backing music to The System. It was all about the nightlife with the ladies of the night.
Oh, really?
Yes. I mean,
it's
just called The System, yeah.
You know, all this cool stuff, all this music I'm talking about is on YouTube. And, you know, which is, you know, incredible that you can just go in there and find anything you want. That's why, you know what makes me mad is the kids today, you know, they got everything at their disposal as far as doing the research and looking for old music, and they don't use it, you know?
Well, my grandkids do. They know all the songs now. They go on Tube looking at our stuff, and I mean, in fact, they keep nicking my vinyl. So
right.
There's the phone. Oh, God. Hold on.
That's okay.
It's,
no problem.
Hold on, I'll try and swipe it, open it. I don't know who it is. It'll ring again. It's probably
That's
the
okay.
wife. She's in Ireland.
Oh, she's in Ireland.
Oh, yeah, it's me. Hold on, I'll just check in the phone.
Yep, no problem.
Hold on. It's probably the wife. She's in Ireland.
Okay.
I'm proud. Can I answer this?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello? Who is it?
We're on the air waiting for
John. Ring me back, Charles. I'm on the phone to the States.
He's on the phone right now.
It's
BBS Radio.
It's just my brother. It's my brother, Mia. We have got some bad news today. My elder brother's got cancer.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry to hear
that. Yeah, so he's got cancer of the throat, cancer of the left lung, and his kidney.
No.
So I've got to go to the hospital tomorrow to see him. So that was our Charlie ringing me to give me the information. So, you know, he is nearly 80, so.
Right. Is he in Liverpool?
Yeah, he's in exactly hospital, Liverpool.
Huh.
So
well, I just got
interrupted.
That's okay. I've had the weirdest things happen while I was on the air with people. I've had dogs barking in the background because everyone's got a dog nowadays.
Oh, I don't have a dog. We used to have a dog called Buddy, would you believe? He died a few months ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, Buddy was great. Oh, he reminds me of Buddy Ollie.
I wanted to mention a couple of Chris Curtis.
Chris, yeah.
He left the band in 66, but a lot of people probably don't know. He was responsible for forming Deep Purple because
he
started that band Roundabout. Yeah. With John
Lord
and Richie Blackmore.
Well, I kept in touch with Chris and he used to remotely stand there. I remember him telling me about that. He said, I'm starting a group. I'm calling it either Roundabout or Embryo. And I says, oh. And the next minute, Richie Blackmore and all the lads said, no, that that title's no good, and they end up with Deep Purple, and then they sack Chris.
That you know, most people don't even know that.
I know, it's one of those things, you know. Chris was always full of ideas, but very good ideas, but he got in with the wrong people in London, and it was just a sad case with Chris. He came back to Liverpool, and he wasn't himself. The drugs had impaired his brain, and he worked, in fact, not far from Johnson's factory. He worked at Ballyhoo Road at the war bonds, and in the end, he worked there for a few years, and they had to replace him because he was mentally unfit.
That's a shame.
I like Chris. Was great. He was such an intelligent bloke, and he was the star man of the band.
Right, right. What was your experience when you first came to America?
When we did the Ed Sullivan show, we loved it. I mean, one of our ambitions was to go to the States, to where all our idols came from, and we just loved it. We were just amazed at all New York. And you imagine, we were like young lads going to New York. It was like mind-blowing. It's like, you couldn't explain it. But when we started touring there, it was very, very hard. Overnight traveling and buses and stuff like that. And not only that, there was lots of financial dealings, which we didn't like. It was a minefield over there.
Mm. Yeah, it was tough back then because, you know, you guys, when you're young, you don't really know too much about financing, you know?
We don't know anything about it. And we always trusted our agent, but he wasn't as bright as the Americans.
Right.
And the Americans knew what to do, and we didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, the prime example, which is written in folklore now, is the merchandise deal the Beatles got was unbelievable. It was shocking, in fact.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I guess you guys came out okay after it was all over.
Yeah, we did. That's what I say. Good. I'm quite happy. I had a nice career, and still enjoying music even to this day. And 54 years playing the guitar was great.
I got a question for you that I think it was Billy Jay that actually gave me a surprising answer. Pete Best. Were you surprised when they fired Pete Best, when the Beatles fired Pete Best?
I wasn't, and I was. Had rumors about him being not a bad drummer, but he was, as you can say, socially not in with the other lads, if you know what I mean.
Right, right.
And he was also quite very good looking, and the girls liked
him. Exactly.
But I don't think he was in the same temperament or mood or life being fun, if you know what I mean. In the band, you've got to be enjoy your company. And if one band member is slightly skee-whiff from another, it creates tension. And I think that's what was wrong with Pete. I mean, his drumming was great. I'm not sure whether he was good enough to record because he always played, you know, four beats on the bass drum all the time. But there were the rumours I heard, and I wasn't surprised when they actually got shut through.
Yeah, Billy Jay said he was very popular with the girls. The girls really.
Oh yeah, he was unbelievable, but socially, he didn't integrate with the lads, you know.
Right, you can tell by just looking at the pictures, you know.
I'm sure he always looks the part.
Yeah.
You know, but he was a good-looking bloke, and he looked the part, leather jacket and all that stuff.
He was kind of like a James Dean type of guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Stuart Sutcliffe, you know,
right,
the friction between him and Paul.
I heard he was offered the job with the Mercy Beats from, I think, Brian Epstein offered him a job working with the Mercy Beats at that time, too, but he turned it down.
I didn't know that story. That's a new one on me.
Yeah.
I know most stories, but that's a new one.
But you know what's very strange about this whole thing, and I talked to Pete about this, is why all these years they haven't really connected with Pete. I mean, I would have probably brought him on
that
stage.
That should tell you right away.
Yeah.
There was something wrong.
There is something wrong. What, you know, why not bring him on stage, you know? I mean, people would like that, you know, make amends, you know.
Yeah, but you don't, I mean, we got a thing now. I mean, Mike Penn tried to, when he left Mike, he tried to take the name with him. And as I started the band with Tony Jackson, blah, 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 with Tony West, Mike tried to take the name with him. We had to put an injunction on him to stop him using the search's name. That type of thing goes on lots of bands. I mean, you've got loads of people going, using the names. And I think there was something like that with Pete Best as regards, you know, using names and stuff. So, there's got to be something wrong when they haven't sort of recognized or even... I believe they gave them some of the royalties from those early recordings. And that's all
maybe
I know about
it. Maybe a deal was made, you know, that, you know...
I think so, because he got a few pounds.
Yeah. Because I saw Pete, and I met Pete in Maryland at a small club. He did like a little tour, and he played Beatles songs, you know? And he had his band look like the early Beatles, you know, like when he was in the band. They were all from Liverpool.
Yep.
Yeah?
Yeah, the Pete Best Band, I believe.
The Pete Best Band, yeah. They were actually pretty good. I mean, he had a second drummer with him.
Again, that says it, says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
It's true.
I've heard mixed things.
All right, being Phil
drummer,
Collins being
wasn't.
To have a second drummer.
Yeah.
Hello?
I know.
I think my phone's dying.
Is it going?
Can you hear me?
Oh. I can hear you good.
I'm going to change phones. Hold on a minute.
Okay.
Hold on. Yeah, I'm going to try use the main phone. Hold on. Hello?
I'm here.
Hello? Ah,
can you hear
better.
Me?
Yeah.
Does that work?
I'll just
hit. Okay.
Yeah, that's better. My battery was dying on this portable.
Oh, okay. You know, I was looking. I couldn't find it on YouTube, and I hope somebody puts it out there. You guys did a... an extended live version of Neil Young's Southern Man, didn't you?
we also did Sandman as well.
See, that's out of character for the band, and I got to hear it.
we were doing venues all around Europe, and we were playing long sets, and we thought, oh, you know, let's do something different. So we all liked Neil Young, and we liked Sandman as well. And so we did them, and it got out of hand. We were doing loads of guitar solos and stuff, and just enjoying ourselves. In fact, I liked it. That was in the 70, about 74.
That's right.
Yeah, and I liked it all, but and then we wore casual instead of suits, but it was a funny period. I liked it very much. It was a relief period.
And you guys got signed, maybe because of that song, to Sire Records, right? Back in 1979, and you got a multi-record deal. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Seymour came to see us down in Southend, the talk of the South. And Seymour and Stein said, "Who came to your show?" Blah blah. And it wasn't particularly a good show. I mean, it's a bit crap, really. And then he walked in the dressing room and said, "Yeah, we'll do it. Okay, see ya." And off he went.
See, you guys were such good musicians. You guys could have probably transitioned into kind of a different genre. Like the Moody Blues started at R&B and they turned into like progressive rock. I think you guys could have probably done the same thing.
Yeah, the problem with myself, really, is and Mike at the time, we were both married, we were both bringing up kids, and I think we were always dashing home, you know, so we wouldn't basically rehearse or do anything till. Well, in fact, the Sire thing was the best thing we ever did. I loved it so much. But Mike didn't like it. He wasn't enjoying it a bit. He wanted to go home to family.
Okay.
Yeah, he wants to get home, you know. Home beds. Well, we were Liverpool. Well, two of us were Liverpool home beds.
So, how are you feeling, John? I know you had a stroke back last year sometime, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a stroke September last year, and I was shocked. I thought, that's me finished. I couldn't. My speech had gone. My mouth had dropped. My left hand and right hand wouldn't operate, do what my brain says. I couldn't play. And the stroke nurses guided me through it. They said, look, now, you just follow our instructions and you'll be okay.
Right.
So I did. I never drove for 4 months. And then, you know, trying to learn, I mean, some of the stuff I used to know I can't play. I've kept now to the basics of the searches stuff. It took me ages to learn walk in the room riff again. It was weird, totally weird. But I know it's fine now. I have the odd blip now and then where you're doing an intro like for Take Me For What I'm Worth. I start the intro and I can't remember the next bit.
Really?
Yeah, and all the lads laugh. All the lads laugh, and then it comes into me. When it comes to the lyrics, I just play it. It really is weird.
Yeah.
It's your brain trying to find new pathways
of all this stuff
in your brain, and also to get your hands working, because what happens, it gives you so much fatigue that you really are tired. And that's what happens. And it's getting stronger by the day, but it's not getting there quick enough. So.
Well, what do they attribute your stroke to? I mean, high blood pressure?
They don't know. Genetics? I mean, it seems I've had a stroke before. When they MRI your skull, I mean your brain, they shows a grey matter, which said you've had a stroke before. And I said, no, I haven't had a stroke before. He said, you have. And then they said, I can show you. And they showed me on the screen and said, that's it there. And I said, don't remember that at all. And he said, well, you've had one before, but minor one, and you've got this one, but just take it easy, which I have done, and it's coming together. I mean, as I say, a few lapses.
Yeah. Well, take care of yourself. You know, I know you're on a heavy duty schedule here.
That's what they all say. Yeah. Oh, well, anyway,
that's a heck of a schedule you got.
Hey?
That's a heck of a schedule you guys got coming up. I'm telling you, I was really surprised you had that many dates.
Oh, well, you know, it's quite easy once you get into it, you know, as long as you enjoy it. If it's a pain, you don't like playing, and it's a pain to do it. It's not worth doing. I mean, we have a laugh on stage, and our audience, we want them to go out with a smile on their face and have enjoyed the show.
Yeah. John, here's your last question for you. This is a question
I
ask everybody. If you had a Field of Dreams wish like the movie to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
It's got to be Buddy, isn't it?
Buddy, yeah.
Buddy Holly, yeah. I mean, it is so simple but great. You know, it's got the guitar technique was unbelievable. You know, it's. I'm still learning stuff now that he's done.
Is that
right? I'm trying to learn what I used to know, if you know what I mean. So, I like all of the stuff, the way he plays the guitar and like Words of Love and things like that. It was unique.
Yeah, you hear so much of Buddy's music in, you know, the Beatles, you know, in your music. I mean, you hear bits and pieces all the time.
Oh, yeah. It's in ours. It's inbred in all the Liverpool bands, you know.
It is.
I mean, you can't shake it. I mean, you try and get a young guitar player to play some. They don't play it the same. Spencer James in our band, he can't play it.
Right.
He can't play the rhythms. It's a joke. So,
yeah.
You know.
You know, I admire it. It's so cool how the Americans and the Brits shaped rock and roll together. If it wasn't for each other, it would have never happened, because the Brits brought the blues back. You know, we had all these great blues artists from the early 20s and everything, and we were forgotten. And then, you know, guys like John Mayall and people like that brought them all back, Savoy Brown, and I can go on and on.
It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
We have a saying here, taking the coals to Newcastle, where the coal come from. So it's one of those things, you know. Oh, it's funny. It is a funny game.
It's a great story. Rock and roll is such a great story. It really is.
Rock and roll has been my life, you know.
Me too. Yeah. I just hope the future gets better, because it's right now it's kind of sad, with the kind of music that's on mainstream radio, and it's all the same stuff.
Well, it's rehash of the 60s and 50s, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all the new guitar bands are just like we were years ago, but not as good, not as different, and it's very difficult to explain. So
we were so lucky to be, you know, have been living.
Well, we were so lucky. I'm older than you. I the 50s was great. Charlie Gracie,
I lived through the 60s.
Eddie Cochran, all those people. And before that, you know, all your country acts. You know, Hank Williams is one of my favorites as well. Because my brother used to bring all the records home from New York, because he was in the Navy, so it was good.
That was the only way you guys could get that kind of music, because the British radio, you didn't have that many stations, right? Play, yeah.
Yeah, we used to get. Thank you. In fact, the lad who was my brother who was ill now, he used to bring all the Johnny Cash early stuff and you know, stuff like Fats Domino and Gene. He brought me the very first Gene Vincent album over. It was great.
I'm good friends with Janet Robbins. Her dad was Marty Robbins. Remember Marty Robbins?
Oh, Marty Robbins, yeah.
Yeah.
Again,
Janet,
he was
cool.
All those stuff, it's great, you know.
Yep. The old westerns, still love them.
Well, that's why the name, The Searchers.
Yeah. That's right. That's how you got your name.
Yeah, that's why we liked all that stuff. You know, we loved all that stuff.
Yep. Good old John Wayne.
Yep. Get off your ass.
John, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really, really appreciate it. For all the incredible music you brought us with The Searchers over the years. Have a great tour. And, you know.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks for ringing on the dot. It was very good of you. And most people don't.
We miss you in America, though. You know, John, we miss you in America.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to go back, but in fact, it's down to Frank, really. Frank, he's on holiday at the moment. He's in, I don't know where he is, Spain or somewhere.
Yeah.
So it's all down to him.
Well, maybe
all
after the Searchers retire, you can, you know, collaborate with someone, start a new band.
I think if I hadn't had the stroke, I think I'd have carried on.
Yeah,
because
I agree.
Fine sometimes, and then other times I'm fatigued.
Yeah.
So I'm still in between making the decision, if you know what I mean.
Well, the main thing is to keep active, you know?
Thank you very much.
Keep active after you retire. Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. Okay, well, take care. Thank
you
for your interview.
Thank
you,
John.
Look after yourself. Hope
to
see you sometime.
Cheers. Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Keep in touch, all right? Bye-bye. Very special thanks to Allen Field Associates for arranging this interview with John McNally and, of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsom of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each broadcast of the Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at theRayShashoShow@gmail.com. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business. Available now at iUniverse.com and Amazon.com. I promise you will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.